Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast, Gavin Gallagher. Oh, beautiful to have you here. I've been listening to your podcast and buzzing because you and me are in the same headspace. So welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Much appreciated. I'm glad to be here. And I can say I'm the same. I've been listening to your podcast. I listened to yourself and Dan Sullivan, of course, and then to Charlie Redding. So I've been enjoying your own podcast.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. So before we have our mutual love in, I'm going to embarrass you by reeling off your greatest hits. This is what I do at the start of our interview.
Go ahead.
Embarrass you and then bring you crashing back down to earth with your worst possible stories. Gavin is a bit of a sort of legend in the real estate industry, particularly in Dublin, where he is based. But he has not just been based in Dublin. For the last 25 years, he's been, I would say, all over the world. Is that correct?
Pretty much.
Yeah. So Ireland, the UK, Spain, New York, Middle East in various places, and Africa.
Ghana, Accra in Ghana, yeah.
Making, investing, building, developing. And he's a director of a family business, which has been going for 50 years, is that right?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know the exact date, but yeah, it's three generations now.
And there, he's responsible for operations at a very large development called East Point in Dublin.
Yeah, it's a business park here in Dublin, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I was looking at it. It's 40 acres. Is that right?
It's quite big, all right. We bought the site back in the 90s, early 90s. In fact, before that, we bought it, I think, in 89 or 88. And it was a former landfill site that the local authority basically wanted to offload. And we thought, interesting waterfront site, 40 acres, very, very close to the city center. So we bought it and we spent about 5 years we're doing all the remediation work, and then we got to work on this big master plan, and it's taken us quite a few years to do it, but we built 37 buildings, and we have a lot of big name tenants like Google and Oracle and people like that.
That's amazing. And I believe that when it's not lockdown, there's 8,000 or 9,000 people there every day. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a pretty there's a lot of people coming in, and the, you know, the role that I have is kind of to make it all run smoothly. And we would have, during the normal times pre-lockdown, we had a number of shuttles bringing people to the local train station and to the local tram and all of these things. And we were doing ourselves about 3,500 people a day on our shuttles.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, quite a big, you know, quite a lot of moving parts. And we had 2,500 cars a day coming into the place. So we had to manage the traffic and the parking, and we have another 1,000 people cycling in and another, I don't know how many people coming in on foot. So it was pretty active role. And then obviously with 50 plus or corporate occupiers, you tend to get a lot of inbound email with, you know, problem solving and firefighting and stuff. So, but it's been great because I feel like a real expert in terms of the corporate workplace and how all of that goes together and the different things that are motivating and causing kind of disruption in the workplace.
One of the things that's really great about Gavin, actually, when you get into listening to him and his content, is he's really focused on innovation and technology, and particularly he's got some threads around collaborating with people in the real estate game, which is perhaps something you wouldn't associate with that sector. And so I think it's sort of a progressive view there, which I think is really great. And hopefully we'll get into some of that on this conversation. So we've listed his amazing achievements and great stuff there, but he's been extremely open that this has been a very bumpy ride on this 25-year period. That's your quote. And there's a kind of, we're going to get into some of that, but he's been really helping people in that particular sector by being very open about these stories. And he's got a great podcast called Behind the Facade, which I very much recommend. Even if you're not into property, I've been listening to these podcasts and it's really full of great stuff. And there's a lot of overlap with what we talk about here on this podcast. And I'm just going to quote, exploring the often overlooked but critically important mental and emotional game governing success in real estate. And I thought that was a really great, because you could just say in quotes, life.
Yeah, I think I mean, the thing is you've got to kind of niche down to find an audience. But the reality is that could just read investment, but it could also go beyond that and just be just general life. Because I am kind of a student as much as a teacher, and I kind of like reading and learning from other people. And I'm constantly kind of looking for ways to strengthen the mind and kind of improve my mindset. And over the years, I've been a bit kind of loose around the mindset, and I've kind of slipped on occasions. And you do pay a price when you make those slips. And so I like to talk about it now, having recovered from it, because I do think that people go out there and all it takes is you to take your eye off the ball in this particular sector, and you can lose a lot of money very quickly, and you can actually suffer quite badly.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you've described is kind of my story, but different. And I think I totally agree. What I'm trying to do here is help other people avoid the mistakes I've made and work on their mental fitness, mental frameworks, mindset. And on that spirit, I'm going to just do a little plug here. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. I always forget to say this. I've never said this at all, but we are trying to help people here. I'm trying to help people like Gavin is in his podcast. So if you subscribe, rate, and review on your preferred podcast platform, we can help people. So please do that. Don't forget. Tell everybody about it. And so I'm going to segue neatly here to the subject of drifting away from the optimum mindset and making mistakes. Gavin has said, and I love this quote, he's had some incredible successes and some dreadful failures that I wish I could forget. Unfortunately for you, Gavin, today
you're going to remind me.
We're going to rake them all up again.
Wonderful.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, it's. I read that and laughed because I thought, yeah, well, I'm going to not let you forget it. But I'm going to take you back in time to pre-2008. And just prior to getting asking you the question, the sort of global financial crash of 2008 was really, as I read it, your personal big crash. But in the run-up to that, what I'm interested to start off with our conversation, you were flying high.
Big time, yeah.
This Celtic tiger made real, right? So I want to give it I want to picture in my mind, if you could just let us know, what was the Celtic tiger, Gavin? What was in his head? What was he doing? How was he spending his time? What was he spending his money on? What were you doing back in 2006-07?
Well, back in 2006-07, I was about 5 years into this kind of massive runaway train that I had created for myself. And it was a very exciting and a kind of time because in my mind, I had figured out the magic formula for making money. And the way it was going, I literally hadn't seen a single failure in 5 years of throwing darts at, various sites and buying things and stuff. And I had some spectacular success. And I think that kind of goes to the head if you're not careful. And I didn't have a mentor kind of guiding me. And so when this stuff was happening to me, I was putting it all down to my incredible intelligence and my genius qualities and all of this, rather than being told, hold on a second, Gavin, you're very lucky. You happen to have been in the right place at the right time. Just give you an example, one particular property deal I did, I bought a property. I was going to spend, 18 months developing it and then, putting tenants in and doing all this. But along came a big financial institution that happened to be looking at that site when I snapped it up. And they came along and just said immediately, we want that and we'll pay you basically whatever you want. And so in the space of 6 weeks, I made a 2.5 million euro profit. Right. And I mean, literally that, which was more profit than I would have made over 18 months. But these guys were so desperate, I basically could smell blood and I just went for it. And I came out of that thinking to myself, I am this, incredible genius that I can do no wrong. And so why don't I do the same deal, except make it 10 times larger and I'll get the same kind of, result, but it'll be 10 times larger or larger again. And so I had this mindset that I could do no wrong. And because of that, I was very much living in this kind of, I think I was just so focused on, how to spend the money, because at this stage, I honestly thought that I was on this freight train heading towards 100 million in the next couple of years. And it was like, it did feel genuinely to me like there was absolutely, that was inevitable. And I was living in a 6-bedroom mansion in a really nice part of Dublin. I was 35 years of age. I had no mortgage. Everything was looking pretty rosy. But I decided that the house next door, which was even bigger, and it was an old kind of Edwardian kind of place, I'd like to buy that, and I'd like to completely renovate it from top to, you know, and turn it into a 10-bedroom mansion. And it will have all of the, all of this. And so I was kind of, as quickly as I was making it, I was looking for ways to spend it on lifestyle and all this, and traveling first class everywhere. And, you know, I just, now looking back, I completely, you know, it's easy to say this in retrospect. At the time, I thought that this was all what people who are extremely successful do. They just spend their days looking through, you know, websites and magazines, looking for things to buy. And I was doing this kind of stupidly, not realizing that the 2008 crash was coming, and all of this debt that I was accumulating was going to come back and really bite me in the ass.
So there was a kind of positive feedback loop.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, actually.
Of doom, like propelling you further and further over the cliff edge. Like I've got this Wile E. Coyote sort of style here.
Yeah, every success led to a bigger loan from the bank, and not just, you know, more success on top of that, but then greater spending, greater, you know, lifestyle ambition. I was, you know, there was people from NetJets contacting me, asking me, did I want to buy one of their marquee cards and stuff to have a private jet at my beck and call, this kind of thing. And instead of, like, you know, laughing at and kind of like hanging up the phone, I went, oh yeah, that's actually interesting. I must consider this, as if I needed it. Like I had absolutely no need for it whatsoever. But you get into that kind of ridiculous mindset where you think that this is all essential. And now I have to say, I wasn't alone, because the entire Irish economy was kind of on the smoking the same joint. And we had like 127 helicopters registered in the year of 2006. And like, we're a small country, and for 126 helicopters to be registered in the same year. And it was all these guys, you know, all property developers, all kind of feeling like, oh, you know, I build in different counties, and therefore I need a helicopter to get back to and from the sites. And then mostly it was used to get to the race course when they were going racing and stuff. But this was the kind of euphoria that the entire country got in. And so some of the good habits and stuff that I started out with that I used to kind of build my initial wealth went out the window, and I started playing catch up and comparison with everyone else.
Okay, so your adrenaline's pumping.
Big time.
Your ego's pumping.
Ego was the biggest problem is that the ego was just now out of control. And I didn't have somebody around me who was doing similar deals and making similar sort of quantums of money to be able to sort of say to me, Gavin, this is all going to come crashing down. You need to, you know, like that money that you're making, put it into paying down debt. Don't be, you know, looking for the next purchase, you know, instead. Like, and I, because I didn't have that guidance from somebody that had done, been there and done it all before, I was kind of like, you know, leave me alone. This is like, I know what I'm doing kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to ego, and I'd like to dig into that, because that's my nemesis. Right. and so your ego's pumping, your adrenaline's pumping, everybody else's ego and adrenaline is pumping. So you're in a micro culture going, this is normal. All right. And then what happened?
Well, I tell you, the first hint that things can go wrong was before the 2008 crash, there was actually a bit of a blip in the stock market. And I had a friend, this is again going back to comparison and the stupid things that we do, but I had a friend, a good friend of mine from college. He was playing the stock market, and he wasn't playing it with his own money. He was playing with contracts for difference. And to anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's where you use basically a margin, and you would have, you know, if I put, in my case, I put 100,000 into a bank account, into a stockbroking account, and I could buy up to $1 million worth of shares, and it would be on the margin is what they would call it. So as long as the margin was maintained, as long as you were going up, there was no loss, but you would take all of the benefit and have none of the losses until the market turned, and then suddenly you would have multiplication of your losses. And so I put 100,000 into this account, and literally in a couple of weeks, that became 200,000. And I can remember thinking, whoa, like this is a runaway train, like the property market. So I threw another 150,000 in. So I'm now 250 of my own cash thrown in. And within 4 months, that was at 850,000. And so I was just like, whoa, this is really like, you know, this is as good as the property market. So 600 grand in 4 months, I thought, you know, I really am this genius, you know? And so I can remember, I was on two stocks, like all that money was on riding on two stocks. One was an oil company, oil exploration, and one was a gold exploration company. And I was, you know, and they had gone for, they were like penny stocks that had gone from like 2 to 8 or 10 or whatever. And I was just like, this is going to keep going. And I can remember somebody saying, geez, you know, at that amount, would you not sell? I can, you know, take your profit. And I was like, you know what? I'll sell as soon as it hits a million. I'll sell. And like, if you just think about the stupidity of that statement, like a million, this like arbitrary sum that has nothing to do with the underlying asset. It's just when it hits a million, I'll sell. And sure enough, there was a hiccup in the market. And this, the 850 became 650. And then I said, oh, okay, I'll wait until it gets back to 850 and then I'll sell. Mm. Then it hit 450 and then it hit 350 and then it hit 250. And then it goes below the margin. And suddenly I've got the broker ringing me up. And it happened to actually on my birthday. And I was sitting by the pool in the south of Spain where I was living at the time. And I had my kids, my young children running around playing with me. And they, I get this call and it's, hi Gavin, it's the broker. We need 80 grand by the close of business or we're going to have to close you out. And I was just like, oh, gee, what? You know, like, this is my birthday. Like, can you leave me alone? No, by close of business, 80 grand, please. And so that was a rude awakening. And so I got on to my office and I was like, transfer 80 grand, quick, you know, do it. So that was done. And like the next day, they were calling me up for another 50 grand. And I can remember like going, are you kidding me? And like another 50 grand, like it was 80 yesterday. It's another. So the next day was another 20 grand. And I just said, you know what? Close out the whole bloody lot because I had gone from 850 to zero. And now I was down another 150. And I can remember just thinking to myself, like, bloody hell. Like, I mean, what a swing in fortunes. And that was before the property market had actually started to correct. So I was thinking to myself, okay, you know, you've had a little bit of a, you know, you've burned your fingers here, time to kind of move on, get back to the stuff you know what you're doing. And of course, while that was happening, the market, it's the Irish market and rest of the world was basically getting ready for the Lehman Brothers collapse.
So you had this sort of a rumble that happened in your world that was a kind of pre-earthquake rumble.
Yeah.
And you figured that was the earthquake.
That was the earthquake. Yeah. Yeah. Rather than thinking this whole, you know, house of cards coming down, I was thinking, all right, I lost a couple of the top cards. I better learn from this, you know.
So your ego's still going, I've learned. Great. Crack on. And so what happened then?
Well, it was another couple of months. I mean, the thing is this didn't all happen, you know, it's like we can obviously talk about this in the space of an hour, but the reality is this probably happened over like a 2-year period. Mm. So it's kind of like a death of a thousand cuts. You keep on getting these like painful jabs and they teach you a lesson. So I started to get a bit nervous about the market. I started, you know, I was looking at a lot of American television and I was looking at this, you know, talk about the housing market and the bubble and all this. And I was just thinking to myself, you know what? I'm a bit nervous about this. I think things are actually going to turn negative. So I started to try to get out and I started trying to sell assets. And I had a couple of assets that I couldn't do anything with because they were in the middle of a big development project. So one of them was, you know, still in the ground being built. So you can't do anything with that. You just have to keep going. But there was other ones that were kind of finished product. And I kind of thought, okay, I'll offload those. So one in particular, I put up for sale and I found a buyer. And another one I put up for sale and I had a buyer pretty quickly. And it was like the total amount of profit from those two deals was going to be about 3.5 million or something like that. So that was going to bring in 3.5 million. I was going to use that money to pay down debt to get the other projects that I couldn't do anything with just kind of under control. And I thought, I'll just organize myself and I'll be sitting on some cash and I'll be nicely positioned for this. But the market just kept on getting shakier and shakier. And both of those buyers within the space of about a month dropped out of the projects, of the buying. And I suddenly found myself in the situation, well, I was going to be sitting on 3.5 million. Now I'm actually sitting on nothing, zero cash. And I can see the signals are getting worse and worse. And there was nothing I could do about it. So I just basically had to kind of sit back. And the only thing that I could do initially was actually lay off a load of my staff, because I was spending, you know, so much a month on salaries and stuff like that. And I was starting to take money from my personal sort of savings to pay for the salaries, because the income just wasn't coming in to match it. And I was thinking to myself, damn it now, what am I going to do? And so the really difficult bit was when you built up an organization and you have all of these, you know, heads that are kind of helping you manage it, and they've all got their own roles. And if you let go a load of those people, the functions they were doing suddenly fall back on you to do. And so I went from having, you know, time to be creative and look for deals, suddenly to finding all of these people, all of these jobs, all of these headaches that were normally handled by my staff, suddenly like on my table. And I had three people working for me to manage what was being handled before by eight people. And it was really suddenly like, whoa, you know, this is like, I don't have time now to even think creatively about getting out of the trouble. It's just firefighting, constantly firefighting. Wow. So it started to impact me mentally. I started to kind of feel the pressure, and I can remember another birthday passing, and my family had come to visit, and there was my mother and everyone were all there, and they were all out having drinks. And I was sitting over my computer, like sending these frantic emails, like trying to raise money and stuff. And I can remember them all, Gavin, come on out. Like, what the hell? You know, why aren't you enjoying your birthday? And they just didn't realize that, you know, it was really, the things were looking really, really bad. And I knew at this stage that I was heading for, you know, almost certain collapse of everything, because I had so much debt, and the way that the market was kind of spiraling down in terms of values, I was looking at a 16 million negative situation, where I would be not just back to zero, but back to minus 16 million in kind of liabilities greater than my assets, shall we say. Mm. And so that was this, you know, there was this feeling of, what can I do? Like, how can I prevent this from happening? And it was just frantic. So I was jumping on airplanes, flying to the Middle East, trying to find, you know, wealthy Saudi investors or somebody to go and plug money into the project. And that would help me sort of stave off this collapse. And so I was so focused on all of that and trying to deal with the banks that were kind of calling in loans on a constant basis that my marriage actually collapsed. I was spending so much time abroad and all this, and the whole thing was just fell apart basically. And so it was this double whammy of you're dealing with all this stress, you've lost your staff, and now you've had to move out of the house because your marriage has collapsed. I mean, what more can I add to the, you know, to the weight of concrete that's on my shoulders and my back here? So it got really stressful. And I started to kind of feel a, you know, depression and stuff like that. And I can remember it took a good year or two of this. And I've said it multiple times before describing it, like a death by a thousand cuts, like literally just every day, something else, something else, something else. Every time you get just a little bit up, bang, another one takes you down. Mm. And I can remember just thinking to myself, you know, this sense of regret that, you know, all of that money that was passing through my hands, that was so easy to get. So, you know, and I was so, you know, I just thought to myself that this was so easy that I can just spend it like willy-nilly. And suddenly, the regret that I didn't realize just how important that money would have been and how it could have staved off this collapse. So very, very difficult couple of years, beat myself up a lot. And then it actually got worse. I ended up, the banks pulled the plug on me and I ended up with zero income. And I actually had to fall back on my brother to help bail me out. And he actually had a place that he was renting and the tenant had moved out. So he had an available house. And he said, you know, if you need it, you can move in there. And I actually took him up on that for a year or two. And it was so humbling. Because only a year or two before that, I had been, you know, he was kind of like saying, well, not a year or two, but a few years before that, I was, you know, flying first class and, you know, spending money like the big cheese. And he's like, you know, why don't you just like take it easy, man, and, you know, be a little bit more modest and humble and stuff. And suddenly here I am kind of like needing a bailout from him. So very humbling moment. And it was kind of rock bottom between the banks and all this. And I can remember at that point feeling like, okay, I cannot get any lower. So how am I going to dig myself out of this? I stopped blaming other people. I used to, you know, for the 3 years that kind of tumble took, I spent the entire thing blaming everyone else for it. I said, you know, it was the bank's fault for pulling the plug. It was the economy's fault. It was, you know, the politician's fault. It was everyone's fault but my own. And it was only when I kind of hit the rock bottom that I kind of said, okay, hold on a second, stop this bullshit and just focus on how you're going to dig yourself out of this hole. And that's when I kind of suddenly started to pay attention to these kind of guys that talk about resilience and the likes of David Goggins and Jocko Willink and people like that who are kind of tough and hard. And you suddenly sort of say, you know what, I can deal with this. Now, I did have a couple of reminders because I had two family members actually take their own lives in that time. And it's to be witness to that and to see the aftermath and how it leaves family members and stuff. It's very, very acute what you see and what you witness. And so I kind of, even though I had gone through this like depression and I felt, you know, like nothing could get any worse, having sort of witnessed family members going through, you know, the aftermath of suicide and stuff, I thought to myself, no, I can handle this. I can deal with this. And the meaning I'm going to put behind all of this is that I'm actually going to go out there and share this and talk about it and try to help others so they don't, you know, succumb to the likes of suicide or get themselves into the trouble in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long way down. You know, it's interesting you describe that. You're on the top of the mountain and now you're way underneath, buried underneath that mountain. And I think what's been interesting in your story is there's still further to go down. You know, even as you're sat there eating humble pie in your brother's apartment, I imagine all those conversations ringing in your ears.
Yeah.
There's still further to go down. But you've managed to arrest that descent. And I think it was interesting for me because I can relate. I mean, it's a different story. It was financially not in anywhere near as difficult a situation as you. But the thing that helped me was actually Jocko Willink's concept of extreme ownership.
Yeah, I love that book.
Yeah, that just those two words. It's like it's such an incredibly empowering. There we go. You show the book is on his desk right here. Great. the idea that it's all your fault, basically, it's on you, right? And this is a very deep philosophical or even spiritual teaching, but he's packaged it up in his sort of way, very masculine, very rooted in the military, etc. But the fact is you can stand behind your own choices and decisions, and that then means you can fix them.
Yeah, that's one of the big realizations is that once you're kind of hit rock bottom, as long as you're open to, you know, the reality of the situation, not deluding yourself. I kept on, you know, I still had this ego telling me that, you know, oh, I can go and get a job for hundreds of thousands a year and I'll get myself back on top and all this. And it's only when you realize that, hold on a second, quit the bullshit. Just get yourself humble, first of all. Stop blaming other people. Stop looking for the magic tablet that's going to kind of turn everything, the clock back and make everything back to the way it was. I mean, I'm way down and I have a long road back, but at least now I've kind of owned up and I've decided that that's what I'm going to do. And I've put some meaning behind it that's kind of bigger than myself insofar as trying to guide others and keep them out of harm's way and try to kind of teach them the, you know, that this ego can just go and play such games with you that you can end up with, you know, you can end up in a really dark place. And a lot of people, peers and stuff, actually took their lives during that same period because their egos have got so tied up with the success and the wealth.
I wanted to talk to you about that specifically because I think this is a really, really interesting point because I got tuned into ego and the concepts around ego, but your identity wrapped up with external things.
Yeah.
Can you speak on that? Because I think that's a really important thing for people to sort of grasp.
Well, I saw it in my own self, but also I saw it in others. And part of the problem is that you compare yourself with others. And I think that is one of the biggest no-nos. And if you take an example of, say, Warren Buffett or something, you can see how somebody like him is not concerned with what other people are doing. I mean, he could buy, you know, pretty much anything, and he just has this humble lifestyle where he just drives the same car and stuff. Whereas other people with a fraction of his wealth, they spend all the time looking around saying, he's got a new car. Geez, I have to go and like keep up with him. And I have to, my watch isn't as fancy as that watch. I need to go and buy that watch. And this kind of game that you're really just playing the game with yourself. You think that you're in this, you know, this game with other people, and it's like a zero sum game. It's just, as long as you're winning, you feel like great. But the reality is that you have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. Like, those people could be living from, you know, straight on the back of the debt that they borrowed from the bank, and they could have everything borrowed, not a single penny of savings. You just don't know. Or they might have family that are kind of feeding them and stuff like that, and that they haven't made any of this money. And so it's a very, very slippery slope once you get into the whole comparison lifestyle and comparing yourself to others, constantly kind of looking to buy. And your ego plays a big part of that. You start to think that, you know, this watch and this car all shows how successful I am, as opposed to somebody who goes out there and just builds a good business and enjoys the impact that they have on society. You know, if you tie your success to wealth and to kind of the material things that you can pick up along the way, then you'll never be happy, because there'll always be somebody who's just bought the newer car or the better model watch or whatever it is. And so you've got to try to distance yourself from that, I think. And I mean, it's great to buy nice things, but to buy it for the right reasons, not to be this kind of comparison that, you know, it's this equals success and otherwise I'm not successful in my mind.
Yeah. And almost, I guess this is where the suicide thing kicks in. It's like, well, if I lose all this stuff, I am therefore nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Who am I? And I saw that, and I can remember hearing stories about people who did it, and, you know, they had bought a helicopter and the bank took the helicopter back. And when the bank took the helicopter, they couldn't even afford the insurance on the helicopter, let alone the payments on the helicopter. I mean, that's how, you know, close to the they were living to the edge, you know. And of course, I was guilty of the same. But when I look at it, I kind of think to myself, what on earth made you think that you needed a helicopter if you honestly can't afford the insurance on the bloody thing, you know? But we were living in this kind of crazy thing where people seemed to get caught up in these cliques where you're going to the race course, and if you don't arrive by helicopter, you're kind of a nobody. And you find it hard to kind of stand there and feel like a man because the other three guys that you're with arrived by their own helicopter. And this kind of, it sounds like utter nonsense now, but when you're living in that environment and you're surrounded by this kind of, what's the best word for it? I mean, it's kind of a toxic environment. But everyone thinks that it's a sign of success while they're living it, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a kind of collective psychosis, like a herd mentality thing.
Yeah.
The madness of crowds. And there's lots of little microcultures like this all dotted around all over. I mean, one I've had a lot of exposure to is tech startups, right? And tech startup land and venture capital funding and raising money and what's your valuation and how about this? What's your exit? And it's like the world according to venture capital that all these people in WeWork have swallowed as the way the world is.
You're absolutely right. I was speaking to a guest of mine on my podcast not long ago, and he went through this incredible growth story, and he built up a business in a very short period of time to, you know, 250 staff in 7 countries, or I think 12 countries, but he did it all just on profits, not a single penny of outside finance. And his advice at the end of it was just like, you've got all these people out there that their first and only objective is must find an investor, must take investor capital as soon as possible. And he says, like, what are you doing? You're giving away your business. Like, you'll end up an employee as opposed to just owning the business and growing it, you know, organically.
Yeah. And this is I think, so this is kind of like psychosis. I see it now, just like in real time. There's all this stuff on LinkedIn or social media. And it's like people buy into that because, and so there's like a reality that is created that serves the purpose of the system, the banks, the whatever. And you buy into it because you believe I'm going to win this game because my ego tells me I'm the cleverest. Even you said, I am this genius. And you tell yourself you are. But is it even a game worth playing? Is a question a lot of people don't ask.
Well, I think it boils down to your mental strength, ultimately. Because if you're watching friends and peers making lots of money in the short term, and you feel envious because of this comparison that you're doing. I mean, you know, you see people, I hear the stories, I'm watching YouTube videos, and there's guys that are buying Dogecoin, and there's this young guy, 26, and he's up a couple of million, and 99.9% of his wealth is in Dogecoin, and he's up, you know, 4 million or something like that, and he borrowed 100,000 to get himself up 4 million, and then in overnight, when some tweet came out from Elon Musk or something, and the guy lost 2.5 million of his net worth, and why he didn't pull out, you know, 200 grand and pay off the debt, the original debt, at least. And if you want to let it ride, you know, take some back. But then the people, they'll be thinking, oh God, you know, I could have, you know, it could have gone to 10 and I've gone and sold off. So you get, I think in order to participate in the market, you have to buy into the market. Whereas if you're strong of mind, you can kind of say, you know what, those guys are playing a game. And it's like a game of roulette. And yes, they're doing great right now, but there'll be a point where they lose. And, you know, like Nick Leeson in the Barings Bank back in the 80s or whatever, I mean, you keep on putting it down and you keep doubling up the bet. And eventually you're riding on, you know, 2 billion for the next deal. And if you don't get that, you have to go to 4 billion. And it just keeps on growing and growing. And you either accept total defeat or you keep going, you know? And so I think it is, I see it happening all over the market at the moment. I see house prices jumping up, going crazy. I see asset prices going crazy. I was listening to somebody yesterday talking about sort of baseball cards or something like that. There's something that's being traded in the US online. And it, 1 year ago, it was 58,000 to buy this, you know, rare baseball card. And yesterday, the latest price for the same card was 750 grand. And it's in the space of 12 months, that's what it's shot up. And when you see that happening, you know that we are on the precipice of some sort of another crash. But you go and say that out there and you're called a crank and you've been told all sorts of stuff. So, you know, the best thing is just to sit back. And as Warren Buffett says, you know, when people are being greedy, be fearful. And vice versa then. So I think suddenly what will happen is there's going to be something that will trigger some sort of a crash. Everything's going to come toppling down. And then there'll be everyone thinking that, oh, it's gone way too far. It's going to keep going. That's when people step in and start buying again.
Interesting. Okay, so we've had this salutary tale where you kind of hit rock bottom. You've done 1,000 cuts, but you've accepted responsibility. You've seen how far further it could go down with taking your own life, and you were able to get out of that loop and move up and sort of and take that ownership for your future. So you've got a long path there. So what are the things you learned looking back now? Because, you know, however many years it is, you will have learned certain tactics or ways of getting on. What's come out of that? What helps you even today?
Well, one of the things that you've got to do is disconnect that association with wealth and success. Success is what you make of it. And if success is only measured by wealth, then you're going to end up with a pretty shallow kind of life. I measure it against the quality of my children, you know, their mindset, how strong they are mentally, things like that. I also look at my fitness. I like, you know, you and I share the love of fitness and stuff. So when I was, you know, at rock bottom, I wasn't really paying much attention to my fitness. And it was only when I started saying, you know what, I have to stop worrying about the stuff I can't control and just work on what I can control. And so getting up early in the morning and getting out and doing a nice run or going for a bike ride or swim or whatever it is that I like to do, triathlon. And then in my case, I'm particularly suited to calisthenics and stuff. So I do a lot of burpees and press ups and chin ups and all that kind of stuff. And I like to just punish myself physically with as many as I can do. So I set myself challenges like, you know, I've got to do 1,000 in under 2 hours or whatever it is. And that kind of thing, it gives you a project to kind of aim for. And the project, it just takes your mind off an awful lot of stuff, and it just makes you kind of focused on a couple of goals that you can control, as opposed to being, you know, caught by every single passing kind of trend that comes by. Mm. And it allows you to focus on what you can control. I don't look at what other people are driving. I don't look at, you know, the quality of their watch. I don't look at all that kind of stuff, because I know from my own experience that they could be just one of those guys that are living the high life right now, and it'll all get pulled out from under them in due course. And so what's the point in comparison, in using that as a comparison? Because you just don't know what's going on.
It's something interesting here. Like, so you kind of in this point where you had to surrender your ego and get over yourself and get onto this other path. And this is, I think, what you're talking about now, this other path, which is more humble. It's a bit more about challenging yourself to be that, have that kind of discipline. And I've got to say, it was 1,040-odd, I think you said you did.
It was my birthday. It was 1,000 plus my birthday. So I'm turning 49 this year. And so I'll be doing on my birthday 1,049 burpees this year.
If anybody's done 10 burpees, you'll know that's rough. 1,049 is, I don't know how you can do that. But I'm very impressed because funnily enough, so you mentioned there just very kindly that I'm into fitness like you. But I would like to say I've been sort of tinkering around the edges of this until perhaps the pandemic, and then got really into running, and then have got into ultra marathon running in the last sort of 3 months. And the point being is I didn't know I could do that. But what I'm learning by doing that, it reminds me, the process of running a very long run reminds me of the process of me digging my business out, right? And you said this, you got to kind of accept it and just walk the path, right? Literally in my case, right? Keep plodding on. Now, what have you learned from these sort of these challenges, and what can you see in terms of how it relates in terms of your mindset and how you're embodying that for your business life?
Well, one of the things that when I look back now, I try to sort of look for the lessons in the mistakes that I made and stuff. And one of the biggest ones was I was impatient, I was impulsive, and I had a total lack of discipline. I didn't have a disciplined mindset around due diligence, around what my decision making was, around buying things, and just, you know, the materialistic kind of way. And so I talk about patience and discipline being very, very important in this business, and consistency. Mm. And so I kind of think, compare the, you know, the physical world and fitness and health and stuff like that. You've got to be disciplined. You've got to be consistent. But you also have to be patient. You know, you don't get success overnight when you're trying to, you know, do an Ironman or run a marathon or something. You just can't go out and do it overnight, but you can build over time. And in the same way you can build a business, or you can build a portfolio or your wealth. You've got to look at it as consistent, disciplined steps over time, and just consistently done without this impatience that you want to have it all today, because that's the downfall. When you can't just sort of wait for the next reward, and you have to kind of have it now today by going to the bank and borrowing money so that you can have the car today, rather than waiting until you've succeeded and then maybe taking some of that money out and giving yourself a little pat on the back.
Yeah, it's that almost delayed gratification.
That's it. I think delayed gratification is super important, and it's a discipline that you need to give yourself. And so I look at these events, and we were talking about David Goggins and that idea of callous your mind and stuff. I mean, I did the 4x4x48 back in November.
And what is that? For those that don't know, David Goggins is...
Yeah, David Goggins is a former Navy SEAL. I have his book here, and he went from this very adverse life situation to managing to get very disciplined, and he managed to get through the training that they need to do, even though he was way too heavy and out of shape and all that. And he turned into this ultra endurance athlete. And it's a very inspiring read. But one of the things that he talks about is don't constantly look for the easy way out. I mean, people will walk into a building and if they have to go to the 10th floor, it's first thing you do is go straight to the elevator. Take the stairs. It's tough. It's hard. It's not comfortable. Yes, that's why you do it. In the same way, the 4x4x48, it's to go and run 4 miles every 4 hours for 48 hours around the clock. So it was 12 times I went out the door, I ran 4 miles. And I started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. My next one was at 8 o'clock. The next one was at midnight. The next one was at 4 a.m. The next one was at 8 a.m. And it's like that for 12 of them until you've done a full 48 hours. And in fact, I went ahead and did an additional one at the end because I wanted to do 52 miles in 2 days, which is a double marathon, basically. Mm. And it's very tough. And it's mentally tough because you've come in at, you know, about 1 o'clock in the morning, you're sweating, you're feeling hot, and you go to bed. And 3 hours later, you're getting up to go and do it again. Like, it's very uncomfortable. And that's what I love about it, is just the fact that there's not many people who would actually voluntarily decide to go and do this. And that's why I want to go and do it.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about it, because people might be listening to this rightly thinking, that's crazy. However, and this is I think the lesson that's nested in here, Goggins in his book talks about callousing your mind so you can cope with really challenging circumstances. Now, that could be physical circumstances like what you've just described, or a double marathon. It could be a military circumstance like he was in the Navy SEALs. But as business owners and leaders and entrepreneurs, we are every day faced with challenging circumstances that will test you. And so by callousing your mind, by roughing it up, by getting it strong, then you could something crops up because, I don't know, somebody didn't pay you on time. Suddenly it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
You can roll with the punches more.
And I think it's a very good point, because at the end of the day, like, we've chosen to be entrepreneurs, to run businesses and stuff. And with that, you know, there's a fallacy out there that, oh, you know, being an entrepreneur, it's super glamorous and you can do this and you can have this lifestyle. And they've kind of glorified it. You know, every time you look at an Instagram post these days, it's kind of like entrepreneur. And I kind of think, is that supposed to be some sort of like badge of honor? It's the reality is entrepreneur's life is tough for the vast majority of them. And there's this glorification of it. But the reality is that if you choose to be an entrepreneur, every single day is a potential problem. Now, you do have great ups when you win a contract and you make money and stuff, there's great ups, but you have devastatingly down days as well.
Yeah.
And you have to embrace both. You can't just say, I just want the good days and I don't want the challenging days. Because if that's the case, you're going to end up on this roller coaster ride that's going to be no fun. Whereas if you just say, you know what, these challenging days, they're just as much a part of the journey, and therefore I'm going to embrace them.
Yeah, Goggins talks about doing something that sucks every day.
Yeah.
And I kind of
jump into an ice bath or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's funny enough, I started getting into Wim Hof. Start of lockdown. And he obviously, this is cold showers and running in the snow and stuff. And so cold showers, I most days have a cold shower, right? And I never want to have a cold shower, ever.
Yeah, right? Same. Right?
So I walk in, and here's what happens. I walk in and I'm like, you don't have to have a cold shower. It's fine. You had one yesterday. Mate, you're tired. You've had a rough day. You've got a lot on. You've got to host a podcast today. Give yourself a break. Have a warm shower. And then I kind of trick myself into having a cold shower. Right? I hate it. And I'm squealing like a little pig. Right? And I'm like, meh! And then after about 10 seconds, I'm like into it. And then I'm in there for 2, maybe 3 minutes. And it's like meditation. It switches my brain off. It recharges my body. And I come out. And it doesn't matter what the day throws at me, because in the first 3 minutes of the day, I've conquered the cold shower.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I have a good friend. I have two good friends that are mad into all this stuff. And JP and Brady, and we're in a WhatsApp group together, and we share these kind of extreme things that we do with one another. And they both really enjoy this stuff. And what they've done is they bought, you know, a refrigerator, like a deep freeze refrigerator, and fill it with water, and they keep water in it below zero. So it's actually, you got to break the ice on the top of the bloody thing to get in. And they, and Brady has done this and gotten in and sat for 30 minutes in sub-zero, I mean, where you've got to break the ice to actually get into the water.
Wow.
And I mean, that is a whole different level. So I look at that and I kind of go, whoa, you know, my little, you know, trickle of cold water down my back is not quite the same level, you know.
That's brilliant. We're coming towards our end of time. I've got 1,000 things I want to ask you, but I've got limited time. So I'm just going to reiterate something you said there. Peer groups, mastermind groups, people, peers around you to keep you on the path. I know you've spoken about this before, and I think we haven't got time to get into it now, but I think that's a really important thing for people to take out of this, to help you stick to the path, build your group around you who can help you.
Definitely. Yeah. I think your peers are very important. And, you know, there's that old saying like that you are the average of the five people that you hang out most with. And I do believe in that. And therefore, I spend a lot of time sort of auditing who I'm hanging out with and making sure that they are the right type of people, that they have the mindset that I want to emulate. And that a lot of the time they're better than me at what they do, whether that's fitness or whether that's you know, business or whatever. And that way you kind of level up. My friend JP, just a couple of months ago, he ran 3 marathons in 24 hours. And it involved zero sleep for a 24-hour period. And he ran through the night. And the next day he finished it at like 23 hours and 57 minutes or something like that.
Wow.
But he had done 79 miles or whatever the distance is. And it's just incredible. And he couldn't walk for 3 days, but he did it, you know.
Yeah, so that's the problem. So I think that's a really great takeaway. Surround yourself or find or hassle, curate good people or people who are going to stretch you, because that'll keep you on that path. So the last 5 minutes we got here, I'm going to ask you the question I ask all my guests. But there's, you mentioned about entrepreneurs on social media, and we all know there's about 1 billion pieces of advice for entrepreneurs out there. But what's the piece of advice that you think people should ignore?
Ooh, that's a good one. Well, I think now, having done it myself and paid a big price, I think this idea of going all in can be a very bad piece of advice, because things can go wrong. And as I've learned, you know, people, you know, it's kind of a little bit macho to say, oh, you know, you go all in. So you're playing, you know, let's say you're playing a game of poker and you kind of push all your chips in and you can win, and great, you've cleaned up the board and everyone thinks you're such a sort of such a hunk, you know, because you went and put all the pieces in. But just as quickly, you could lose every single penny in that movement. And I think that that statement, that go all in, can be a bit of a fallacy, and people don't realize that it's not meant as in, you know, leave yourself no options. I think what it is it's supposed to be that don't, you know, narrow your focus. Don't have yourself so spread out on so many different things that, you know, you have a plan A, you have a plan B, you have a plan C. Don't, you know, do that, but don't leave yourself with absolutely no options and put everything in on it. Because as I learned, you can have a market that is cyclical and it's nothing that you've done wrong. It's just the timing sucks and you happen to be dragged down because of that. And that one investment that you went all in on could be the one that pulls you down and forces you to go bankrupt or whatever it might be. Whereas if you leave yourself just a little bit of out and you just remind yourself that there may be the stuff I can control, and there's a whole lot of stuff that I have absolutely zero say in, whether it's inflation or the economy or whatever it is. And therefore, I'm going to just leave myself that little bit of an out in case it's one of those days that this great deal doesn't turn out to be so great.
Yeah, it's one of the problems with entrepreneurs is they're natural optimists.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there's a really fine line, I've said this before, between visionary and delusionary.
Yeah, it's a fine line, and that line often moves as well as your career progresses.
Yeah,
and you know, the vision of having—I can remember when, you know, thinking that I wanted to have this beautiful place in the south of Spain and a beautiful place in Ireland, and I wanted to have the same cars in both locations, so that when I arrived in one, my Range Rover would be—I'd get off the plane in Spain and I'd have a Range Rover. When I arrived home, I'd have the same exact model and everything. Just, you know, ridiculous, but at the time, it was the vision that I was kind of on, and it was delusional. And it was completely sort of silly and unnecessary, but you can get yourself caught up in that whole thinking.
Yeah, I think this is one of the myths of entrepreneurship, is that there's a visionary with a vision and they stake it all on the line and they walk the narrow sort of narrow thin road up the mountain and they get there and everything's perfect. And I think this is sort of yeah, that can happen, but you know, I don't know, there's probably I'd wager there's zero people who've actually that's happened to.
There's a thing called survivorship bias. And it's a cognitive bias where you only hear the stories of the people who made it. So we all love the stories from, you know, Richard Branson and Elon Musk and stuff, but for every one of those, there's 100,000 that ended up bankrupt and without a penny to their name, and yet were there sort of fantasizing at the having your own island in the Bahamas and, you know, flying to space and becoming the richest man in the world and stuff. Those are the things that I can think that's the delusional side. It's the fact that so few people actually attain that, but that's the vision that people have that kind of drives them.
Well, I think we'll finish it up there, because that's a really great piece of, I guess, advice and life lessons, that sort of really be aware of your delusionary as well as your visionary, and be really mindful and grounded. So listen, that's been so great for me. I mean, and it's been such a like compelling story. So Gavin, thanks ever so much for sharing so openly.
Dan, my pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Where should people find you? Where should we send people?
Well, I've got it depends on what kind of platform you like. I have a podcast, as you mentioned, Behind the Facade, and I've also started to produce a lot of content on YouTube. So I have a YouTube channel called just my name, Gavin J. Gallagher. The J is important because there's a lot of Gavin Gallaghers out there. So if you're ever looking for me online, Gavin J. Gallagher.
So Gavin J. Gallagher, and that's right on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I noticed this, by the way, very slick. You got all the same handle. That's very good.
That's intentional, yeah.
Yeah, as a marketing nerd, me, I appreciated that. So well done. Listen, that was brilliant.
I'm glad somebody's paying attention.
Oh, yeah, I paid attention. So please check out the podcast, check out the videos. It's great content. It's full of this great advice. And we've just scratched the surface there. So thanks for joining us on the podcast. Everyone subscribe, like, rate, review, not just my podcast, but Gavin's podcast too. And I'll catch you next time. See you later. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com. And just enter your email address. There's a little box. Just enter it in and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us. Help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.